counsel in the Evans versus State case come forward. Ms. Butko, Mr. McCarthy, you ready to go?
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay, and Ms. Butko, who do you have with you for the record?
Your Honor, today we have Brant Butko associating in on this case in a pro bono capacity.
Welcome.
Carla Butko, on behalf of Mr. Evans, we're ready to go.
Okay.
Your Honor, this is a really very interesting case. What always surprises me when working on these cases is how a two-day jury trial can create so many issues. They shouldn't. One of the reasons a two-day jury trial creates so many issues is we need to develop the law in our state. And that's why we're here. That's why we work on this. So today, Mr. Evans, my client, was 46 years old, mental health issues. He was bipolar. He has a low intelligence factor. He's a drug addict. He was released from prison, went to NMHI for help several times. I need my medications. Wasn't able to get them. Was doing okay until he didn't have his medication for long enough where it impacted him. What I see when I see this case is that we're going to see changes in the future. Because one of the things that Mr. Evans suffered from was a criminal history with felony convictions. Where we are in today's world will be a better place. When the young people with these issues are 20 years out from here, they will have had the benefits of mental health court. They will have had the benefits of drug court. We probably will not see the recidivism rates we have with the generation of Mr. Evans because we are changing our philosophies and helping them. But as it stands today, Mr. Evans qualified for habitual offender enhancement on his case. So what I would like the court to think first when they think of this case is the cumulative error issue, because there are so many issues in this case which are mistakes. And when you add them together, you don't get to a fair conviction. So first of all, we have the jury instruction questions. The failure to instruct the jury on what the term dangerous weapon is. And that ended up being quite an intriguing research project. My assistant and I spent a lot of time on that. And when we get to the bottom line, we don't really have a definition of dangerous weapon at law. Mr. McCarthy conceded that in his brief. He conceded it but put forth, we don't need to tell the jury what a dangerous weapon is because we all know. I would submit it's not that simple because in this case we have a car, an everyday item. We all drove to court today. None of us got arrested for possession of a dangerous weapon today, but we all drove here in our car. A weapon, at dictionary, a thing designed or used for inflicting bodily harm or physical damage. A Suburban is not designed or used to inflict harm to anybody. It's a tool in our life. When we get to the question of a dangerous weapon, how far will we take it? We know it's different than a deadly weapon because a deadly weapon is clearly defined at law. A dangerous weapon, what if I'm running from the scene from a police officer, I throw my shoe at it, hits him in the head and he falls down and hits his head. Have I used a dangerous weapon? Is that how far we're going to go with this? We need a narrow definition of dangerous weapon. Because what we see is...
In this case, it wasn't a shoe. It was a motor vehicle. The example doesn't reconcile with me.
I understand, but what we have to say is the next case in front of you will not be a Suburban. It could be something as innocuous.
We are talking about a Suburban in this case.
True. Yeah. But when I'm urging the court to define a dangerous weapon, I'm urging the court to give that term, make it a term of art. It should be defined at law, and the jury should have been instructed. Mr. Evans, when you saw him driving away, he wasn't aiming his car at the officer. The officer climbed half in and half out of the car, and he was trying to start the car, and she stayed there. That's not consistent with anybody's training. Get out of the way. So it wasn't like he aimed his car at her, or had he been intending to harm someone with that car, the male officer was behind him. He could have put the car in reverse and run over him. That's not what happened here. What happened here is Mr. Evans' co-defendant came running out of the bank yelling, go, go, go. He was caught up in the heat of the motion, started the car, and took off. So when we define this, let's define it as something that includes the word weapon, which means it's inherently dangerous. It's intended to be used as a weapon. Not just that everything could be charged as a dangerous weapon. We do have misdemeanors for these actions, too. So the way that we're enhancing these crimes to felony status is we're adding terms to them. By adding those terms, we need to instruct the juries so they understand how to apply it. The other question, when we go back through the case history, we know Nevada's case history in this subject is very confusing. We have Clem, which tells us the history, which is fascinating. But when we go back in time, we had scissors, we had boots, we had small X-Acto knives, things like that. They're not defined as dangerous weapons. So I think we do need to do a definition. The next question on the instructions was the lesser included offenses. We know in this case that Mr. Lindsay was not feeling well. Mr. Lindsay's a fine attorney, and he's a fine trial attorney. But we know this case caught him at a bad point in his life. We know that because we have record after record where my client says, I like Mr. Lindsay, I respect him, but he's not well. We have Judge Steinheimer telling the world that other courts aren't letting him try cases till he starts to feel a little better. We have Mr. Evans say, I just want a continuance. So we know Mr. Lindsay's not at the top of his game at this point in time. And we don't have any jury instructions for the lesser included offenses. We have two possibilities. We have a leaving the scene of an accident, and we have a misdemeanor resisting an officer.
Doesn't that really go to ineffective assistance of counsel?
It might, but the question on this record is whether there was sufficient evidence if the jury was properly instructed. So my argument is that the jury was not properly instructed. How do I get there? We have a jury question. The jury question comes in and says, Judge, could you please tell us from the record where this bicyclist was when he was supposed to have been hit? Because we know we have Mr. Evans saying, I didn't hit anybody. I didn't hit nothing. His interview to the police goes in. We have the co-defendant testifying. Nobody was hit. I still don't think anybody was hit.
Well, that's the reason why we use ineffective assistance of counsel in these issues, because then you put the lawyer on the stand to see if it was a strategy, a tactical move not to do lesser included. I mean, a lot of times when I tried cases, you know, the state would say, you want a lesser included? I'd say no, because I was going to shoot the moon here and ended up with a lot of people in prison because I was stupid. But that's ineffective assistance of counsel. That's not any type of a failure of proof or anything like that that would require reversal.
And I understand there's two choices to approach this issue. My concern is that we're not telling the jury they have options. And we're looking at a person who is facing habitual offender. The offer prior to trial was 8 to 20. We know that right up front. So we're not looking at a small case where if the person, something goes wrong, it's going to be a fairly minor problem. We're looking at the state's asking for 8 to 20 on a plea bargain. So we know we have a very serious case on our hands. If we can get that felony down to a misdemeanor, we can't get habitual offender status out of it. So there could be no real tactical reason to not instruct that jury properly on the lesser included. And frankly, the judge has 25, 30 years experience. One would expect to at least see a record where they discuss, did the defense counsel want this to occur? Are you waiving that? And we don't have it. The question I raised also is insufficient evidence on the injury to the bicyclist. The only evidence you have of an injury to the bicyclist is the bicyclist. We have no medical records. We have no doctor reports. At preliminary hearing, this man testifies that he has a bruise. He can't testify as to whether he was hurt when his bicycle moved, whether his bicycle was hit or whether he was hit, and he identifies Mr. Lindsay as the driver of the car. So the evidence we have for purposes of Mr. Rafati, the victim, is very minor. Then when we get to trial, this same victim testifies to a bloody nose that the police officers can't substantiate. There was no blood at all. He doesn't even have a scratch on his leg. His own testimony was that he went to the hospital, they told him he had a bruise, it would work itself out and send him home. Is that bodily injury? We don't have a definition of bodily injury either. So if we take this case to its next logical conclusion, could virtually every personal injury accident end up bodily injury under that statute? How far are we going to go?
Can you talk just a little bit about what might have been contained in the record and argued down below regarding the defendant's knowledge that an accident occurred with this bicyclist?
Yes. In the record, they put in Mr. Evans' admission to the police officer, and they played it for the jury. In that record, on at least 7 pages, he tells the officer, "I didn't know anyone got hit. I didn't know anyone got hit. I didn't know there was a bicycle. What bicycle?" And if you think of it logically, he's driving a large, old, suburban vehicle. And the bicyclist, the officer doesn't see it. The officer who's standing behind the male officer testifies, "I didn't see an impact. I didn't see anything." The female officer who's running after the car and is closer testifies that she assumed the bicycle got hit because once Mr. Evans drives by, the bicyclist is getting up off the ground. She didn't see an impact. So did he fall over when he saw this car coming the wrong way down a one-way and hurt himself, or did Mr. Evans hit him? And I would submit to you, if he hit him, shouldn't we have some damage to the bike? Shouldn't we have some pictures of the damage to the bike? Shouldn't we have some pictures of the bruise? Shouldn't we have some medical records? There's no evidence given to this jury other than the victim saying, "He hit me." Is that enough? The statute requires the state prove beyond a reasonable doubt bodily injury. Even the co-defendant, who's brought by the state, who the state says is credible because he's been convicted, and they let that come in front of the jury before he, while he's on the stand, and he's been sentenced for his actions on this case. And they argue he's credible as a witness because he's been sentenced on this case, even that Mr. Thomas said there was no impact, there was no striking by a bicycle, they didn't hit anything. The other thing that was interesting on this case is when they put in Mr. Thomas's conviction in front of the jury, they argued in opening, they asked him while he was on the stand, and they argued it in closing argument. They didn't argue it as would be proper under 50.095, where they say, "Mr. Thomas, have you been convicted of a felony? What felony is that? What year was that?" They asked him, "Have you been convicted of a felony from this case? And were you sentenced on that?" And then they asked, "Have you gotten any bargains from the state for that? And are you testifying here because we brought you under a subpoena?" They argued at closing, Mr. Thomas is credible because he is under a sentence for the facts in this case. And I would argue that violates due process. I'd like to save the rest of my time.
Okay, Ms. Butko.
Thank you.
Good morning, Justice Cherry, Justice Perigary. I'm Terry McCarthy from the Washoe County DA's office on behalf of the state. Well, gosh, what shall we talk about today? There are so many things to talk about.
Why don't you start with why we should define dangerous weapon?
There are things that require additional definitions, but we don't define and then refine and refine again everything when we send things to a jury. It's not a technical definition. It's not a fixture in a real property case. We send it to the jury just with that, with the dangerous weapon. I think that's the only statute we have that refers to a dangerous weapon as opposed to a deadly weapon. It may be an oversight on the part of the legislature. Maybe they should have defined it more thoroughly. But I don't think that we should just suggest that a jury can't understand what it is. But more importantly, whatever it is, it includes this car. So I mean, even when and if there, it ought to have been defined better, it's certainly harmless, even though it's an element. Because there is no definition that would have excluded it, that would have excluded the car as a weapon. I further suggest that no one asked for any additional instructions. Justice Cherry, if I were defending this, I wouldn't want the instruction. I wouldn't want an instruction on what is a deadly weapon or dangerous weapon because it takes away the argument. A proper instruction would have said, whatever else it is, it includes a Suburban. So I think that is, there's nothing to consider there. Although I would admit the better practice would probably be to give some sort of guidance to the jury. But whatever guidance would have been would have included this vehicle. So I think we're making much ado over nothing. So, and the notion of a knowledge of the hit and run, I gotta say that this argument right here, an oral argument, that's the first I've heard of that being raised. So I don't know that it's, I guess the sufficiency of the evidence is raised in general, but that's in terms of the nature of the injury. And the victim testified. And, you know, in other cases, sexual assault, we say the victim's testimony is sufficient if the jury believes it. So I don't think that's anything to talk about. But if we're looking for circumstantial evidence of the knowledge of the collision, I suspect it would be that the defendant immediately turned right after the collision. He's heading down the one-way street on the wrong way. There's a collision, and then he turns off and heads up the hill. So that would be some circumstantial evidence that he was aware of the collision. There is, on the lesser included offenses, I guess the point I was trying to make in the brief is that it's not that it is indeed tactical, but that it could be tactical. Somebody has the authority to make the decision. Do I wish to roll the dice, or do I wish to increase the chances of a conviction on a lesser offense? There are some debates among courts on who makes that decision, whether it be the client or the lawyer or the two of them together, but it's not the court. That much we ought to be clear on. It's not the court that gets to make that tactical decision. This court has suggested from time to time that it should be the court making that decision. We go back and the court said that in Lisby. I don't think it's necessary to overrule it. It sure would be nice, because I think that the court ought to now recognize this is a tactical decision and that it should be reserved to the parties and not to the court. We have going back to dangerous weapons, I think I will point out once again that there was no offer of an instruction, and we didn't have one even in the briefs. And what we have now in the oral argument is a kind of a half of a proposed instruction, but it's appears to be based on Justice Stephen's dissent in Zondik, saying whatever else it may include, it should first include a weapon. But that, I would remind the court, is a case concerning deadly weapons. That was Zomick was a fellow that stomped somebody with his steel-toed boots. And I would also remind the court that that opinion didn't carry the day. The notion that an accomplice, that there is some rule of law that prohibits letting the jury know that the accomplice has pleaded guilty and been convicted and been sentenced and therefore is not beholden to the government, I got to say I'm unfamiliar with that rule of law. I'm unfamiliar with any source of law that would support it. I would remind the court, if you were going to develop such a rule of law, that it would apply to the defense. If there's an evidence rule, it would say, no, Mr. Defendant, you cannot ask the same question. You cannot try to show some bias, some sort of favor to the government. Well, there is no such rule of law, and there ought not to be such a rule of law. The truth of the matter is, prosecutor went and he fired the first shot, and he responded to the claim of bias before it was raised. But he said, you don't owe me anything. You've already been sentenced. Whether it was that case or a different case, I think the jury's going to figure it out when everyone starts pointing at each other and saying, yes, that's the fellow that was there. So I guess the point is there's no source of law that supports the conclusion that we cannot ask an accomplice if he's been convicted for his participation in the crime. There is also an argument that this court should overrule O'Neill and should allow the jury to decide whether someone should be sentenced as a habitual criminal. In the words of Br'er Rabbit, oh, please don't throw me in the briar patch. I'd love such a rule, actually, that would allow the prosecutor to show a jury that someone is a habitual criminal. I think we'd get better sentences out of it, but thus far there is no law, and this court has decided that the better rule of law is described in O'Neill, and there's really no need to overturn it. But how
many felony convictions did he have prior to these convictions?
I don't know. Sufficient number. I don't know. If he's a drug addict, I suspect there are an adequate number. And I noticed here in my brief, I never expressly responded to one of the arguments. And the argument seems to be that there was an instruction to view the defendant's admissions with caution. And I think I impliedly addressed it, but not expressly, so let me just be more specific now. The instruction, once again, we have the decisions of defense counsel. If I were defending and court said to the jury, view the confession with caution, I don't think I'd object to that, even if it's not required. And that's all it was. It was admissions and confessions which should be viewed with caution. The proper instruction, if we're talking about other than admissions, is the statements of the defendant ought not to be considered at all for the defendant. Because the evidence code is that they're only admissible against the defendant. So I suggest that there's no problem with instructing the jury to view the statements or the admissions of the defendant with caution. I don't know why the judge did that, and it certainly favored the defendant, and I can't imagine how he can claim to have been prejudiced by it. Now, if the judge had said, view his testimony with caution, that would be something we could have a discussion about. But there was no such instruction. There's also an argument in the briefs that the court should have stricken part of the pre-sentence report. The lawyer appearing at the sentencing hearing said the lawyer was comfortable with the remedy that the court gave. That seems to invite doing nothing else. So that I'd suggest there's no error there either.
Mr. McCarthy, there seems to be an open question in our jurisprudence about whether, and you touched on it earlier, but I'm not sure it was adequately discussed, whether the scene of an accident, leaving the scene of an accident causing injury requires a demonstration that there's knowledge on the part of the defendant that an accident occurred. And thus far, your argument has been that there's circumstantial evidence he had knowledge of an accident because he turned right. And I guess the bicyclist said he hit him.
Two witnesses claimed that there was a collision.
I'm sorry?
Two witnesses testified to a collision. And frankly, I'm not prepared to respond to the question. There is, I don't have the statute in front of me. I don't know if it includes an element of knowledge or not. I would suggest that this argument that appears to have been raised by the court for the first time in oral argument, which you certainly have the authority to do. However, I think the better thing to do is, if the court's really interested, is to order additional briefing on the subject. In the briefs, the argument concerns the sufficiency of the evidence of an injury and the fact of the collision, not whether there is an additional element. And I hate to admit that there are things I'm not all that cognizant of, and one of them is the precise terms of the statute. So I can't answer.
No, that's fine.
I would invite you to order additional briefing. You know, there's nothing I like better than to sit down and write additional briefs. So. I know I didn't answer that question. I hope I've answered your other questions. With that, I think I've responded to everything, and if the court has no questions, I'm done.
Any questions for Mr. McCarthy?
No.
All right, thank you, Mr. McCarthy. Ms. Butko, you have a little bit of time remaining for your rebuttal.
Thank you. May it please the court. Interestingly enough, there is one location in our statutes that defines dangerous weapon, and that's in 202.265, cited in my brief, and it cites it as dirk, dagger, incendiary device, gun, knife, weapon, clearly meaning weapon. It doesn't say average items of tools that people would have on their possessions. The insufficiency evidence question is clearly raised on both prongs in this brief at pages 17 and 18, plus in the opening facts, I went to great detail to quote what the officer saw versus what the victim said versus what the defendant and co-defendant said. So
again, was your point strictly as it related to the injury that occurred and knowledge of the injury itself, or your argument that perhaps there's a knowledge element required in this statute?
I think it's a knowledge issue, because when he left,
how did you argue that?
I argued that he knows he's eluding the police. He's going down a run, and Mr. McCarthy says he turns right. Sure, he came out of this parking lot, turned the wrong way into a one-way street, and got out of that fast. It's hot August nights. So there's a lot of traffic. So then he takes off through the city streets. He doesn't know there's any accident. He doesn't know he's hit anybody. And there's insufficient evidence to show that he knew or had reason to know. Because it's a bicycle, even the officers can't say how the accident happened, if the accident happened. And they're standing right there.
But you didn't really point to any points and authorities that would support the position that knowledge was required as an element in this prosecution under that statute.
I suppose it's, the interpretation of how you argue it. Because I argued the jury couldn't find the essential elements, and I argued McNair and Jackson. And those essential elements, one of those would be knowledge. So.
Under Detloff, assuming that the argument is viewed by the panel as focused on your client's awareness of an injury, didn't Detloff say that the state need not prove that the defendant had knowledge that an injury occurred?
But don't they have to prove that he knew the impact occurred? That's, in this case, you just don't have anything to show he knew the impact occurred. So I think it's a little different. And very quickly, I would ask you to look hard at the O'Neill issue. We now have Lafler versus Cooper and Missouri versus Fry, and our notice statute allows the state to file after all the plea bargaining stage is over. So 94% of the cases plea bargain. How can an attorney be effective plea bargaining if they don't know habitual offenders on the table? It should be noticed. Thank you.
Okay, thank you, Ms. Butko and Mr. McCarthy. As always, we appreciate your good briefing and arguments on this case, and it will stand.